Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning into episode 129 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm. Or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, and I do want to hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. Currently, you can donate to the show via PayPal using the email address david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.html for more information. And now for some feedback. Robert via email wrote, "I'm a retired engineer who recently discovered your podcasts, which I'm now working through. I think the sort of work you're doing with the podcast is fundamentally important and want to thank you for making it available. Oh man, there are so many broken things. It's hard to choose what to concentrate one's effort upon, what to try to fix. I just listened to your 2014 interview with Harold Hillman, which was about electron microscopy and people reading into it more than is there or interpreting artifacts as real things. Robert continues, his work aligns with Gerald Pollack's intuitively appealing approach to cellular function. Again, thank you for your work. And Robert, thank you for your comments. Mo, also via email, wrote, was just listening to your latest podcast, Malcolm Kendrick on cholesterol, heart disease, etc. Glad you managed to get him on. I know from a brief comment, a conversation on his blog, that he's sympathetic to HIV skepticism, but that's as far as it goes, at least publicly. On Facebook, there was a conversation following the airing of the Dr. Kendrick show between Mindy and Donald. Mindy wrote, I listened to the podcast of this show. I had a hard time hearing Dr. Kendrick. The sound quality was so hard to hear on my computer. And if I can just put in an aside, apologies for that. There were some difficulties with the sound quality. We tried to amplify it as much as we could, but it still wasn't as crystal clear as it should have been. What I heard on fat and cholesterol was very good. I couldn't believe my ears when Dr. Kendrick refused to take a position on vaccines and made a remark about those who have done their own research and determined the facts about safety and efficacy of each or all vaccines, resulting in the decision to say the vaccines don't work. Poor Dr. Kendrick. He hasn't done research on vaccines. Maybe he's afraid to take more than one position, which might negatively impact his book sales. Ugh. Well, this was my response. I said, well, he was negative on the HPV vaccine, which was the only question on vaccine I asked him. He started by saying he didn't want to take a position, but if you listen to the whole discussion, he ended up did take a negative position on that vaccine. I sense that he's scared of taking on this issue that's not his core, and I think that fear amongst doctors who step outside the mainstream is real and justified. It's also very sad that people who are supposed to advise us on health don't feel that they can give an honest opinion on a controversial medical subject, and I think most things in medicine are somewhat controversial. Donald on Facebook wrote, I wish I had an honest doctor with a sense of humor like Malcolm Kendrick. One question is, if you have no more fat cells, you get type 2 diabetes. A question for him or for you is what causes someone to lose their fat cells? I don't yet have an answer to the question, but it's an interesting question. It's certainly not within any area that I've investigated. But I will email Malcolm Kendrick, and if I get a response, I'll read it on the show. So if you'd like to see the entire Facebook discussion, please go to the Facebook page, and you can also join the discussion there. And now to our guest, who we will be broadcasting in two episodes due to the length of the discussion. James Lyons Weiler is the president and CEO of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, a not-for-profit organization that conducts research in the public interest. His PhD is in ecology, evolution, and conservation biology, and he also has a postdoc degree in computational molecular biology. He's author of Ebola, An Evolving Story, and Cures versus Profits, and is co-author with Richard Fry of the book that we're going to talk about today, The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So you work for a not-for-profit institute. Could I ask you where the funding for this institute comes from?
All of the funding that comes to the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge comes from public donations. We don't receive any funding from any government agency or from any corporate interests at all.
I can't understand why the government wouldn't want to fund research into vaccine safety, which appears to be the subject of your book. So let's start by having you define autism or autism spectrum disorder, ASD, because we're going to be talking about that a lot, and I think the definition is a little bit...
if you follow the DSM-5, the diagnostic manual used by pediatricians, autism itself is not present. It's a spectrum spectrum of disorders. But classically, autism would be a condition where a person develop symptoms where they were not able to speak. They either lost the ability to speak, or they never developed the ability to speak. They might have repetitive movements in their body, such as hand flapping, tics, and such. Or they may have the third domain of behavior is in social behavior, where they have difficulty in being able to establish and maintain, from our point of view, from the external viewer's point, another person's point of view, social relationships.
So aggressiveness or not wanting to socialize, things like that?
Well, I mean, to the degree that a non-professional could attribute any meaning to somebody not looking at you in your eye when you're speaking, not necessarily waiting for you to finish your sentences, standing too close to you, characteristics, not waiting in line, not waiting your turn, little social cues like that. But then again, there could be, in classic severe autism, just an inability to actually acknowledge that the person is present in the room. This is a type of autism, autism where the individual seems to be in their own world, and they don't react when their parent comes home from work. They don't pick up toys. They fail to point to things. Fail to respond to people pointing to things, and they're very, very much distant from the rest of
them. Right. Other things I've heard, and I don't know if these would be included in autism, are a complete loss of speech, loss of toilet training. Are those just extreme examples of autism, or is that something separate?
Well, autism itself, again, classically defined, was a specific diagnosis. It was first diagnosed in a child whose father worked with mercury fixing lumber by Dr. Keller, and we have since then learned that autism itself, classic autism, is similar to, related to, other kinds of neurodevelopmental disorders such as Asperger's syndrome. And so it's placed on a spectrum, and there are so-called high-functioning autistics who write blogs. And I just attended a concert of people with diagnosis of ASD, a band here in Pittsburgh called Spectrum. After the show, one of the guitar players and singers came up to me and We spoke, and I congratulated him on the show, and I told him I wrote a book, and he was interested. And so, you know, it's not as though everybody that's on the spectrum has the inability to speak.
Right. No, I understand that, and I think, I mean, I've read things that kind of imply that autism makes you a better person, but then I've also read stories about children who regress so much that it's, you know, although the parents obviously still love them, obviously there's a lot lost out of their life.
Right. See, this neurodiversity topic that you brought up, the neurodiversity topic is an interesting social area. Yes, every parent, I know hundreds and hundreds of parents of children with autism, and each and every one of them accepts their child, loves their child. Most that I know would like their children to improve in one way or the other in the areas that lead to autism diagnosis, because parents who love their children always want better for their children. So it's for me, it's not an issue of better or worse. You know, I'll spend time with neurotypical children, and I'll spend time with autistic children in my own social life. And I have neighbors who have autistic kids, and I take their kids to the museum just like everybody else's kid. But that turns out to be a rarity. Where the difficulty is, the difficulty comes especially in the social setting in schools, because you have people in schools who are still undergoing neurological development, still undergoing social development, and the lack of social cues, the lack of social engagement, the quirkiness of kids with autism tends to become stigmatized, and people who don't understand that it's a medical condition, that it has a biological basis, then tend to put those characteristics onto the person's personality. The kids don't know how to relate to this. They don't have the framework.
Right, right. No, I understand that. When I was a young teenager in my Boy Scout group, somebody who worked for when they still had mental hospitals, brought in 3 or 4 severely disabled boys and said, okay, they're going to be part of your scout group. And I had no idea how to handle this, and I'm sure we didn't handle it in the best possible way, because you couldn't really talk to them, you couldn't go camping with them. Like, it was, there was no assistance to understand, you know, why are these people like this? They just seemed weird to me as somebody who had not dealt with people with mental,
right, and when I was a child, you know, we had a friend of mine underwent a severe traumatic brain injury. He was riding his bicycle, and he ended up falling off his bicycle in traffic and hit his head on the curb. And through that traumatic brain injury, he went from being athletic, highly social, one of the most socially popular people I knew at the time. He was seventh or eighth grade. To the special class. They called it the special class at the time.
Mm. And I'm sure
our children are not given any tools with respect to how to deal with, relate to, et cetera, children who have neurodevelopmental disabilities, and an increasing percentage of them do. As you know, the diagnostic rates are at 1 in 68 in the United States, and in some areas as high as 1 in 50, which is 2% of the population,
right,
being most with...
And we need to talk about that, because your book, the title of your book is The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. I want to read from a yesterday Washington Post article, which came out when Robert Kennedy Jr. announced that Trump had asked him to investigate vaccine safety. And there's a comment from Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and President of the Sabin Vaccine Institute. He said, "That's very frightening. It's difficult to imagine anyone less qualified to serve on a commission for vaccine science." "The science is clear," he continued. "Massive evidence showing no link between vaccines and autism. And as both a scientist who develops vaccines for poverty-related neglected diseases and the father of an adult daughter with autism, there's not even any plausibility for a link. Autism is a genetic condition. So you looked into genes a lot. If autism was a genetic condition, why has it skyrocketed from unknown to, I don't know what the latest statistics is, but it's more than one out of 100 boys in particular.
Yeah, so I think the discussion on whether autism is genetic or environmental is an important one. That's why I devoted the time to read the 2,000 studies that I read in preparation for the book to really get a handle on it. I approached the topic of autism as a collection of phenotypes, not necessarily
explain a phenotype, because I don't think most people know what that is.
Oh, sure. So a phenotype is a characteristic. It's a trait or characteristic, such as if you go out into nature and you look at a flower, some flowers have white petals, some flowers have pink petals. That's a phenotype. The height of people is a phenotype. The eye color is a phenotype.
Okay, so if I can, so a genotype is what your actual genes are, and it could be that for a particular flower, they're always white, so the genotype's white, the phenotype's white, but there could be other plants where the phenotype's more variable and the genes don't necessarily direct the color of the flower. It might be caused by environmental conditions, such as especially in parasitic flowers. So the phenotype is a combination of your genes plus environmental influences. Is that approximately true?
Sometimes in genetics, and this has been known for a very long time, an extremely long time. There's nothing new here, but some traits are very simple traits. They're called simple Mendelian genetics. The name Mendelian for the traits comes from Gregor Mendel. Mm-hmm. We all learned about him in high school. He's the monk that studied the inheritance patterns of traits in peas and other plants and organisms, and noticed a specific statistical pattern of inheritance that let him know that, hey, there's information being transmitted from the parent generation to the offspring generation. Some traits are very simple traits like that, and you can tell which parent the trait came from in some organisms. Other traits might involve two or three genes, and those are more complex, and they kind of blend the traits, if you will, a little bit. You might have, instead of just, say, a deep purple petal and a white petal, you might have a pink intermediate or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You could have blending of traits, and other traits are absolutely plastic to the environment. There are plants, let's say, that if you grow it in a dry environment, it develops one type of leaf. But if you move that plant into another environment or develop it or let it grow in another type of environment, a wet environment, it'll develop a different type of leaf or root structure. Those traits are genetic in the sense that the ability to develop those characteristics are definitely inherited from the parents. But the actual trait that you see in any one individual is plastic to the environment. And so studies in genetics in humans around neurodevelopmental disabilities have discovered hundreds of genes, over 800, that may be associated with autism in some way. And in my review of the literature and knowing the molecular function of most of these genes and the proteins that the genes encode, importantly, it's really clear that there's only a tiny handful of truly genes that confer a true genetic risk of autism. When I say autism, I mean ASD.
Right. So how come we didn't have autism, say, 100 years ago? If people have genes that can cause autism.
Well, it's almost, we're the same species as we were 100 years ago, so it's almost...
Mm-hmm. Effectively, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost certain that there were individuals who, upon increased, you know, toxic exposure of the mother in the womb or early in childhood, throughout the Industrial Revolution, it's almost certain that there were neurological developmental disorders that we would call autism today back then, but the rates are off the scale. I mean, there's been an exponential increase from 1 in 10,000 in the 70s to now 1 in 68. If 2% of our population has neurodevelopmental disorders, we should be very concerned, because our brains are our best resources. That's by far, our brains are our best resources.
So are you basically saying that genes produce a predilection to autism? Is a risk, like if you have certain genes, you're less able to deal with some of the environmental factors?
Right. So technically, the right way to think about genes is not if you have a gene or don't have a gene. It's better to think if you have this form of a gene or that form of a gene. Mm-hmm. So you use the word genotype, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. So you might have a type of a gene from mom, and you also inherit another type of the same gene from dad. We all have two copies of the genes that we have. So we all have, say, a gene that's called a BRCA1 gene. We all have a copy of the gene. But some of us have mutations in those genes that confer risk of breast cancer, okay? So we all have the gene. But the specific genotype that a person has can either directly contribute to a dysfunction in, say, the operations of the nerve cells, development of the nerve cells, operations of we'll get into some detail on this later, but can have a direct influence, or the specific type of gene that's inherited from mom or dad could confer increased risk of susceptibility to, say, environmental toxins. And when I say there's 850 genes that are associated with autism, I hope I'm being clear that not all of those genes are autism risk genes. A tiny proportion of those genes would confer risk of autism genetically. Mm-hmm. That is, if the parent of this autistic child has a baby with the parent of another autistic child, and it's true genetic autism, there's an increased risk of autism in their children together, say in a stepchild situation. But they're so rare. Those types of genes are so rare in the population, specifically because they're involved in dysfunction of the cells. People with those types of genes tend not to have, you know, babies. They tend not to have families,
right.
Not to be successful. And so my estimate is that true genetic autism, of all of the cases that we see, much less than 1% of that is true genetic autism.
And so do other genes, I mean, do they play a role? Like you mentioned mercury as connected with the first documented case of autism. So do some genes, say, give you a sensitivity to mercury or aluminum or something like that?
Right. So every day that we're alive, our bodies are confronted with a soup of toxins. And as our society has become, first through the Industrial Revolution and now through changes in agriculture, the way we process, grow and process our food, there's toxins in our homes and in the furniture, in our cars. There's toxins in roadside aluminum dust and so on. There's, you know, chemicals are rich and varied. There's thousands of chemicals in our environment that weren't here 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Many of the genes that are associated with autism fall into a category that I call environmental susceptibility loci. Now, a loci simply means that it's a particular region on the chromosome where a gene resides. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Males have an X and a Y, as everyone should remember. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes, one from mom and one for dad, for the non-sex chromosomes. And every location on that chromosome is called a locus, and if you have a trait that maps to that genetic information that's in that locus, that's called multiple loci are called loci. So there are Genetic environmental susceptibility loci, or genes, I call it loci because it's not just a gene. There's also variations in there that don't map to a particular gene yet. But those variations confer increased risk of environmental susceptibility to toxins in general because the cells are not able to detoxify as well. All right, and most parents of kids with autism will recognize that some days their kids have better days than others.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so what we can then see is, well, maybe they're just for that day they have a reduced exposure to toxins, or they have something in their diet changed, and so they're better able to detoxify. So that's the second category of genes. The first category of genes falls into autism risk genes. And I told you that those are 1% or 2%, less than 1%. And then we have environmental susceptibility genes, and those are fairly common. And those are going to be genes variants of genes that are very frequent in the population. And that's, in fact, what we see with many of the genes that are so-called associated with autism. They're frequent in the population, and they don't really confer autism because a lot of people have those variations and they don't have autism. And then the third category of genes that we have are what I call autism phenotype modifier genes. These are not environmental susceptibility genes, and they're not autism genes. What these are genes that would have contributed to the traits, characteristics of the person, whether they had autism or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they happen to contribute variation in a way that makes accentuates the person's autistic traits.
Okay. So
there's three categories of genes. There might be 850 that are identified that are associated with autism, but if you spread them over three categories, and then you have to look at the fact that spread them over three categories, you can see that autism is not just genetic. It's an environmental disease by far.
If we can talk about that, I mean, is there any dispute that when people are vaccinated, that that some of the components of vaccines have toxicities such as mercury and aluminum? Is there any dispute over that fact?
Well, there's information, and then there's not such good information. What we have is everyone understands mercury is a toxin.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely not debated that ethyl mercury in thimerosal is a toxin. The question is whether it
actually is. It is debated. I have read several times that ethyl mercury is not toxic, and it's only methyl mercury that's toxic. It's a total lie, but I've read it.
This is what I'm saying. It's not debated that it is a toxin, but it is debated whether it is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
The doses in the vaccines, okay? And that's not a very useful discussion, because I just told you that we're all subjected to thousands of toxins all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single one of them might be at a toxic dose.
Right.
But if you have a genetic mutation or a variation that causes you to be less able to detoxify from this soup of toxins, it doesn't matter where the toxins come from. They all have cumulative effects,
right,
and some of them may interact. So you mentioned aluminum and you mentioned mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum and mercury are absolutely synergistically more toxic together than they are independently. This is based on how they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They would have a tendency to be more biologically active and more toxic together. Even if their effects were just additive, we have to ask the question, are the chemicals that are in the vaccines raising the baseline dose of cellular toxicity in people to the point where they reach the tipping point to regress into autism faster due to other environmental toxins as well.
Well, another point is the mechanism of exposure, because I've read several times that you get mercury if you ride your bicycle in the traffic. You get mercury if you eat a tuna fish sandwich, but neither of those are injected into your body, where you bypass a lot of the barriers that the body puts up to eliminate toxins.
That's a very important point. And so, you know, lately, scientists at my institute have been studying what is known about the toxic levels of aluminum. So they removed ethyl mercury in the form of thimerosal from most of the vaccines from the pediatric schedule after a public outcry. And Robert F. Kennedy was really crucial in that.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about clearance of ethyl mercury before we get into aluminum.
Sure.
When I picked up Bobby Kennedy's book, Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak, and everyone should get a copy of this book, it was from him that I learned about a key study by Burbacher et al. A few years ago, where they looked at the tissue, what's called tissue fates of ethyl mercury.
Right.
The study was in rhesus macaque monkeys. Previous clearance studies simply looked at the serum levels. They would inject animals, rats, mice, and so on, and they would look at the serum levels and the urine levels, and they would say, "Oh, well, you know, it's not in the serum, and this amount came out of the urine, and so, you know, it's not in the serum. So, look, it's clearing from the body."
Mm-hmm.
But what Thomas Burbacher et al. Did. It was a much, much better study, much more detailed and sophisticated. They looked at the tissue fates, and they found that the rapid drop in the clearance from the serum was not just due to deposition, clearing out by the kidneys and deposition in the urine, but excretion in the urine. It was also due to deposition in organs, including the brain.
Mm.
That had not been known. And so when you hear people say that ethyl mercury clears from the body faster than methyl mercury, and therefore it's less toxic, point them to the Burbacher et al. Study, because it shows the exact opposite. It shows that methyl mercury actually clears from the body, if you consider tissue fate, faster than ethyl mercury. Ethyl mercury, which we're using in some vaccines still, such as the flu, some flu vaccines, is more toxic than methyl mercury when you look at cellular tissue fates.
Right. When I read the Washington Post article yesterday the first time, I'm sure it said that some people think that thimerosal in vaccines is a problem because it contains mercury, and it says thimerosal contains a tiny amount of mercury. Well, I added up the weights of ethyl mercury, and the mercury is 50% by weight of thimerosal, which I don't think is a tiny amount by any means. Today, the Washington Post article doesn't mention thimerosal. It just talks about a mercury-based additive and doesn't say that it's a tiny amount. So somebody must have taken them to the cleaners over that particular
error. Here's the problem, right? So we have 72 shots in the pediatric schedule for the CDC in the United States, many of them had thimerosal in them. After public outcry, due to the increase in neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism, they took it out. But the key to having them take ethyl mercury out in the form of thimerosal out, one of the keys was that somebody actually did the math and added it up, and there was a time in the schedule where individuals were dosed higher than the FDA-regulated limit.
Yes.
For methyl mercury. And so the party line of people who want you to believe that these over-the-top, unwarranted, irresponsible claims, vaccines are safe. That is not a warranted knowledge claim. When you see people saying vaccines don't cause autism, that's not a knowledge claim. They cause encephalopathy, and the U.S. Vaccine Court has made awards for vaccine-induced encephalopathy mediated autism. They just don't call it autism. They call it encephalopathy. So when you look at the toxic doses of a chemical such as mercury or aluminum, and the FDA has a dose limit, a safe limit. those safe limits are based on no observed adverse event in mice, but many times they're based on no observed adverse event in adult mice or adult animals.
Right.
It's and so when we project that amount of knowledge, we take that knowledge and say, well, we didn't see any adverse event in mice, and then you say, well, we're going to take this amount over to humans. Many times that those federal dose requirements are based on adult human weight. So they'll say for a 150-pound adult, you know, you can get 850 micrograms of aluminum, and that's considered a safe amount based on animal studies. In the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, we're looking at that very problem right now. We have scientists that are doing the calculations and the estimations based on the baby's body weight, not mm-hmm. on adult body weight.
And are babies still given any vaccines with mercury in them?
Yes, there are three vaccines that that have forms with options with or without mercury. Oddly, the CDC was recommending the flu vaccine with dimerosal for use with pregnant women.
Right, I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, you were. Okay, so did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say that, I was just going to say the same thing. The CDC has been recommending that pregnant women get the flu vaccine, and it contains mercury because it's a multi-dose vaccine, and therefore the fetus is going to be exposed to mercury.
Right. So let me tell your listeners is that, first of all, I'm not against successful, safe immunization. No way am I against that. But I have to say that activating the maternal immune system during pregnancy with a vaccine that contains an adjuvant, like an adjuvant is a chemical designed to enhance an immune system response, such
right.
as aluminum, lipopolysaccharides, and so on, is a really stupid thing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mercury is a preservative, and we know it's a neurotoxin, and I think it's an equally stupid thing to vaccinate with a flu vaccine that contains mercury while you're pregnant. The reason why it's stupid to vaccinate during pregnancy is that half of the proteins in that baby's body don't come from the mother, right? They come mm-hmm. from genes that are encoded by their father. And the genetic variation that confers those proteins, their shape and the structure and so on, may differ between the parents. And when they differ and you activate the immune system, you can get you can activate an immune reaction of the mother against fetal proteins.
Hmm.
And in fact, mothers of kids with autism have higher rates of anti-brain protein antigens in their bloodstreams than mothers who of neurotypicals.
Right, because a baby is a foreign body, and the human body has to go to some length to prevent the mother from just rejecting the foreign cells, right? So that's
Absolutely.
A delicate balance, I imagine.
Absolutely. Now, let me say the following, because there will be people who criticize me as being one-sided on this. Getting a flu infection is also risky when you're pregnant, right? Any source of fever during
right.
pregnancy is a potential risk for neurodevelopmental disorder.
Right.
The problem that is that we're at this impasse of people shouting at each other and calling each other names and making these gross overarching statements to try to correct the record, like that doctor did that you cited, saying autism is genetic. It's clearly not. We'll go back to that point in a little while, but the problem is that when the CDC conducted studies on the link between vaccines and autism, and they found no association, they made publications that showed no association.
Mm-hmm.
It left out the results where they did find positive association for two classes of patients. The classes of patients that where the data were left out were on-time vaccination with the MMR
mm-hmm.
versus delayed vaccination with the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella. for African American patients, and also for kids that have autism without any other type of disorder that could be called comorbid disorder. So that so there's two sets of results that were actually physically removed from a PowerPoint presentation by Frank DiStefano of the CDC under the order of Colleen Boyle, to remove them from Dr. William Thompson's PowerPoint presentation. They had to put Dr. William Thompson on administrative leave. They put him on, he was suspended, actually, because he broke protocol and broke rank and went to Julie Gerberding, who was the director of CDC at the time, U.S. CDC
right.
at the time. And for breaking rank and going over Frank DiStefano and Colleen Boyle's head, because he knew that they would listen to them, he was suspended. And so while he was suspended, Frank DiStefano went ahead with the presentation that Dr. William Thompson was complaining to Julie Gerberding about and took the results out and only showed the IOM the results that showed no association, the Institutes of Medicine. Then they went ahead and published it. I have no idea why Thompson let his name be on that paper after all of this, but he did. And then they published it in DiStefano et al., 2004, without the positive association results included. People have to understand that study, the DiStefano et al. Study, also included other subgroups. So it's not as though, well, it's a small subgroup and they didn't think it was going to be significant and so on. No, these were the significant results. And so they actually misled the Institutes of Medicine. And the Institutes of Medicine put out a report that where they concluded that no more science is necessary on the question of vaccines and autism. They used that DiStefano et al. Study, that they used the fraudulent study in their basis of the recommendation that no more science be done, okay? And I have never heard in any other setting, and I'm a widely read scientist in many areas, genetics, genomics, proteomics. I've studied heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's. I've been involved in over 100 research studies. I have never heard another group of scientists say that the question is settled, except for in two areas.
You should study HIV/AIDS because it's been said for a long time that the question is settled, but it's not.
except for in two areas, vaccines, the causation of HIV and in climate change. For those who carry the banner of truth because they managed to convince everyone, the press, the media, and so on, the science world is not scientific. Anybody who says the science is settled is not a scientist.
Right. We still call it the theory of evolution, right? I mean, after hundreds of years, nobody's said, you know, it's time we call it the fact of evolution. And you know, maybe that's just conservatism because we've been used to calling it that way. But it's like people should be encouraged to study evolution and criticize people who try to make an evolutionary connection between two things. It shouldn't always be accepted as the unadorned truth. It discourages critical thinking.
Exactly. And what we're talking about is objectivity in science, right?
Yes.
So you can't maintain objectivity once you... But at some point in time, on some things in science, we have to say we know something, right? So there is background knowledge.
Right.
There are things that we know. It is fact. The science is settled that the sun, the Earth is not at the center of the universe. That is absolutely settled, right? That was all done with observational study. That was never done with experiment, right?
It'd be pretty hard to imagine an experiment for that kind of stuff.
Right. And so you have people, you have knowledge that we have to accept as background knowledge.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, like if we go to physics, you know, if Einstein had taken that approach, he never would have come up with his theories because, you know, Newtonian physics was settled and proven for hundreds of years, and yet it wasn't quite right. It wasn't right at incredibly high speeds, incredibly high energies. It was a really, really good approximation, and when you're standing on Earth, it was essentially a perfect approximation, but it wasn't actually correct. And if we had banned, Einstein from questioning what everybody knew to be the truth, we never would have had the theory of relativity. Maybe we wouldn't have had the atomic bomb, but it's like...
You've made my point. That was my exact analogy that I was
yes.
going to make.
Okay, sorry, I stole that from you.
Didn't steal. We're sharing. It's fine.
Okay.
What you're talking about, the second part of that, then, is the refinement of knowledge, right? So when we try to make a knowledge statement and we say vaccines never cause autism, you're making such a gross generalization. You're telling me that, you know, in 8.5 billion people, if you vaccinate them, vaccines will never cause autism in a single person.
Right.
You have to make that knowledge claim, you have to check every single person if you're going to make that claim. But if you then say, well, wait a minute, you know, vaccines may, there might be a genetically susceptible subgroup, and you say that loud and you say that clearly and you don't mumble over it. So I want to refer people to Cheryl Atkinson's interview of Dr. Frank DiStefano, mm-hmm. where she asked him the question, well, why did you take the results out from that study that had positive results?
Yeah.
His answer wasn't, well, we did another study and we found more data that disproved it, or we did another study, or, you know, his answer wasn't a scientific answer. His answer was, we didn't believe the results, so we removed them. And my answer to that, my response to that is, then why did you do the study in the first place? If you were never going to accept a positive association mm-hmm, result, a vaccine and autism, why did you waste taxpayer dollars doing the study in the first place?
Okay, well, let's go back to this statement of Dr. Hotez in the Washington Post. The science is clear, massive evidence showing no link between vaccines and autism. Okay, so do you believe there are any papers that show a correlation between vaccines and autism? Obviously, correlation is not causation, but do you believe there are papers that show a link or correlation between vaccines and autism?
I believe, I'm going to correct, I know that there are papers that
okay.
are that show correlation. There's no doubt about it. And those are all reviewed in my book.
And how many such papers do you think there are? Like, not exactly, but...
Before I give my estimate of the numbers of papers, I wanted to talk about Dr. Hotez's claim and other people's claim. There are thousands, some people say there are thousands of studies. There's not. Nowhere's near it. Some people say the CDC testified, Rear Admiral Shushat testified to Congress that there are dozens of studies that show no association between vaccines and autism. Those dozens of studies were looked at by the Institutes of Medicine before they rendered their decision that there's no more science is necessary. They rejected 17 out of the 22 studies that the CDC put forward as flawed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a majority of the studies that
right.
show no association were found by the Institutes of Medicine to be methodologically flawed in some
right.
manner that could not be considered for further. Now, that one of those studies was DiStefano et al.
Right.
The very study that we're talking about right now with respect to Dr. William Thompson, the whistleblower, that leaves five studies. They're hanging on by a thread. What people also might not know is that Dr. William Thompson also said that this habit of removing results was par for the course in vaccine science conducted by CDC and their contractees in the 2000s, early 2000s, and that there was another tactic that they used if they found an association in their first analysis. They would reanalyze the data many times over.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk about this. So you mentioned in your book, I think you called it the removal of correlated variables. So, I mean, this is not necessarily a bad procedure, but you're saying it was used in order to remove an association. You might start with an association between vaccines and autism. So explain how you would use this process to get rid of that association.
Right. So let's say that you were well, you know this, but your listeners don't know it. So I want to go back one step further, and then I'll go to your point. There were studies that were conducted by contractees of the CDC where initially association was found, and they were told to reanalyze the data. There was a smoking gun email that's actually reproduced in another book of mine called Cures versus Profits. The smoking gun email came from Dr. Verstraeten, and the subject line of the email says, it just won't go away. And he pleads in his email, for the sake of objectivity and science, we have to accept the result. He's basically saying, we've cooked the data, we've analyzed the data, no matter what we do to the data, we can't make the association go away. I can't fudge this.
Right.
And it's not going to work. That's what he's saying. And then they finally found a way to do it through the removal of correlated variables. Now, let me tell the listeners what that is. If you are looking at specific relationships between specific variables, say height and income, and you're interested in height and income, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to be concerned that part of your analysis, sometimes you identify a variable that might explain income. You want to say, do taller people make more money? So you might already know beforehand that tall people that live in a certain district have more money. But then, you know, if you're going to make a general model that works that's based on height, you should actually consider, what district they live in. And so you might have a district that they live in as another, it's called a covariate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you already know that there's variation in income that's geographic, then it's appropriate, say, to correct for that, maybe across countries or something like that.
And ethnic, because ethnic groups, there's different height, different average heights in different ethnic groups. And so you might be just basically looking at ethnic groups. Taller ethnic groups might just coincidentally be wealthier.
Yeah. It might be right. So then you're saying some important words here that we have to be really clear about. What I said was you might already know it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you already know it, then you can use it as a covariate. If you
suspect
it, then you should test for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you test for its role in a model, it offers additional explanatory power. And if it offers additional explanatory power, you should report it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now what these guys did at the CDC is they would, in one study that was published by a group in the Netherlands, they found an association between vaccination rates and autism. Well, first of all, they learned very quickly that they needed to change data representation. In the earliest studies that the CDC did that were never published, those VSD studies, they looked at cumulative exposures to toxins in the vaccine, okay?
Mm-hmm.
As the variable that might explain autism. They quit doing that because they found an association. Now, later on with the other studies, they would say, okay, well, let's look at the relationship between vaccination and autism, and they found the association. And then they would remove variation. The way that they finally cooked the data to make the association go away was they would say, we're going to remove variation from the model that's related to mother's age, mother's income, gestational duration, of gestational age, okay,
mm-hmm.
of baby, and birth weight. All of those four variables are highly correlated to each other. Young mothers who have low income are malnourished, and they're going to have low birth weight babies, and they're probably going to have preemies.
Right.
So it's one variable. And what they did is they took the variation out many times over.
Right.
And in doing that, then, they left random error. They left random error to be explained by the model. So that's called model overfit. It's also called analysis to result.
Right.
No problem. No, I have no problem if they're going to do that. But they need to publish all of it. They need to publish all of it, and then they need to do what's a formal step called model selection. There are criteria that would tell them whether or not they should remove each and every one of those individual variables.
Right.
And in their presentation, they didn't present that. So we're left with the loss of knowledge by this cooking the data, fudging. I call it statistical sham wizardry.
Mm-hmm.
Fudging the data until you get the result that you want. Absolutely is a destruction of knowledge. It's hiding things from the public, and it's a form of fraud if it's done intentionally. And there's every evidence through emails made publicly available through Safe Minds Freedom of Information Act, through just looking at this study, anybody that knows multivariate statistics can look at the study and say, what are they doing here? Why would they do these variables are highly collinear.
But,
and so through this data fudge factory, we end up with, remember, we're talking about five precious studies.
Right.
We're from 22 to 5. Well, a large study came out called the meta-analysis study, where they cited millions of patients that were considered, and considering these 22 studies and other 22 studies, after the IOM rejected them and said that they were flawed. Now we have charges of malfeasance, charges of fraud, and we know that these studies tend to be underpowered, which means that they weren't large enough individually to find an association if one, in fact, did exist. And a meta-analysis comes out, that meta-analysis is polluted with what RFK Jr. would call junk science.
And are all these five studies that are left, are they all connected with the CDC in terms of the CDC was involved in the research or the publication?
No, they're not. No, they're not. But three out of the five, if I recall correctly, are. I think that's the number. And at least two of them have evidence of this model overfit statistical sham wizardry. That leaves three studies. So when people say that there's thousands of studies, they don't know what they're talking about. It's wishful thinking.
Right, right. Another connection between vaccine and autism is the Hannah Poehling case, where it was actually ruled that Hannah Poehling got autism from a vaccine in her compensation case. Is that not true?
That is exactly correct, and I review that in detail in my book, Cures versus Profits, as well. That case was one of the original five omnibus cases. They aggregated cases in autism to see whether or not through vaccine court, families of kids with autism who regressed into autism after vaccination should be entitled to compensation. Now, Hannah Poehling's case was one case that was originally included in that, and then when they actually made the ruling, they took it out of the omnibus and replaced it with another case. There's a great review of all of the times that the vaccine court did find autism as part of part of the injury caused by vaccines, by Mary Holland and Louis Conti. It's in Pace Law Review, and you can
right.
look it up.
Right. Mary Holland is a lawyer, I think, with a vaccine-injured child, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. I don't know. I believe so. I know she has an autistic child.
Yes.
Yeah, so you asked about the number of studies that support a vaccine autism.
Mm-hmm, yes. Yeah, you didn't give me that. I'm sorry to end this abruptly, but we've run out of time for this week, and I will continue the interview with James Lyons Weiler next week. So you will have to wait for the answer of how many studies there are that show a connection between vaccines and autism until the following week. I appreciate you bearing with me, and I hope you enjoyed the interview so far, and I'm sure you'll enjoy the conclusion. Well, Donald Trump is now U.S. president. Will he follow through with his comments on vaccine side effects and his discussions with RFK Jr. and start to rein in the mandatory vaccine people and start to open up the discussion? I'm certainly concerned about his harsh rhetoric, his personal attributes, his from-the-hip tweets, and the daily contradictions and anger, that he seems more concerned about how many people saw his inauguration than running the country. But the Democratic Party is rotten to the core, putting a dishonest warmonger like Hillary Clinton out front. Let's hope this disaster of an election results in a diminishment of the anger that has surfaced in global politics, largely because the global elites have ripped us off, lied to us, and manipulated our baser instincts to their advantage for decades. It's time for change, but not any change. Thank you for listening to episode 129 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. You can also join the discussion there. And follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.